Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for downloading the 1A podcast for January 4th. Earlier this month, at Susie Sussin tweeted, after downloading the NPR One app after being told to for the 1,000th time by an NPR podcast, thank you, thank you, thank you. Hashtag insert shamed face here. Don't wait like Susie did. NPR One is ready to make driving, cleaning the house, or your post-holiday escape better. Find NPRONE on the App Store. Let's start today's podcast with a quote from former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. To put it mildly, the world is a mess. And she might be right. There's the unrelenting carnage in Syria. South Sudan is teetering on the brink. There's violence in Yemen, Iraq, and the Central African Republic. And for the large part, the rest of the world kind of looks on. What about America's role? Will the new America First approach under President-elect Donald Trump change how the United States responds to humanitarian crises? Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii is a member of the House Armed Services and Foreign Affairs Committees, and she's a combat veteran of 2 Middle East deployments.
I can't tell you how many people I meet with across the state of Hawaii and many different parts of the country who share this call, who feel that their voices are not being heard on the need for our country to end the long-held policy of wars of interventionist regime change, that they have seen how greatly these wars have cost our country, in some cases in loss of American lives, in loss of lives of the people in these countries, as well as the cost, the trillions and trillions of dollars that are spent on these wars. You know, oftentimes in different election cycles, and we heard just recently in the presidential election cycle, some folks will say, okay, well, look, the war, the issue of war is an issue that I care about, but there are many other issues here domestically that are also very important. And I think what many folks recognize, but what is often lost in the conversation here in Washington, is the direct connection between the two. You cannot separate the issue of the cost of these wars and our policies with the lack of resources and the great need that we have in communities all across the country. Whether you're talking about intervention or whether you're talking about contaminated water that's poisoning people in places like Flint, Michigan, and in many other communities across the country, failing bridges, failing roads, the need for resources in our education system and healthcare, and every single one of these issues where there are great challenges and great opportunities here in our country, it can be directly linked to, again, the trillions of dollars that have been spent on these regime change wars and these interventionist policies.
It sounds essentially like what you're saying is that we have to prioritize what we do and you can't spend the same dollar twice.
That's exactly right. We have the dollars that we have the resources that we have, and we have to be realistic and pragmatic about what we can and can't do and what our priorities are. We cannot afford to be the world's police. We have to look at the decisions that we are making within the understanding of how best can we serve the American people. Does this action best serve the safety and security of the American people, as well as analyzing and recognizing if we're considering a course of action in another country or in another part of the world, what is our objective? And understand clearly what that objective is. We've got to ask, we've got to understand and ask the questions about what will be the consequences of this action. How will other countries or other maybe non-state actors respond? What will our response to that be? And how will they respond to that? Actually look down the line and answer the questions to what happens next.
Now, there's an international doctrine called the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine. It's an international norm that was endorsed by all of the UN member states in 2005 that basically says world powers have a duty to step in and save civilians from genocide, from war crimes, when their local governments can't or won't do it, or when they are the offenders. There are people who would say we live in a global community. World powers have a moral responsibility. Even though it's expensive, you want to be a world power, this is the price of admission. What would you say to that?
Well, I challenge back for those who talk about with great intentions, for example, the need to go into Iraq to save people there who were suffering under a terrible dictator, the need to go in and overthrow Gaddafi in Libya, a terrible dictator who was oppressing his people. And we hear the same arguments now again in Syria. This call to action, how did it result? Did it improve the lives of the people of Iraq when Saddam Hussein was overthrown? Have the people of Libya, have their lives been improved since we helped lead the overthrow and eventually really the resulting death of Muammar Gaddafi? Have the people of Syria been helped? Have their lives been improved since we, the United States, working with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, began fueling this regime change war ever since 2011 to overthrow the Syrian government of Assad? The answer clearly in each of these instances is no, which is why I go back to my point. Before we get involved, before we consider any course of action, we must consider what are the consequences of these actions, what is our objective, what is our plan on how to accomplish that, and understand clearly both what it will cost the American people, both in dollars, as well as potentially in American lives, as well as what will the effect and consequence be for these people who we are saying we are trying to go and help.
Congresswoman Gabbard, you are a combat veteran, two tours of duty in the Middle East, and you continue to serve today as a major in the Army National Guard. Talk about how your firsthand experience informed your opinions about U.S. interventions. Did you always feel this way, or did you come to feel this way as a result of being a service member?
Yeah, no, Joshua, my experiences, especially throughout both of my deployments, taught me a lot. I learned a lot and grew a lot as a person through those experiences. My first deployment in particular, you know, I served in a medical unit with the 29th Brigade Combat Team from the Hawaii Army National Guard. We were in Iraq for about 12 months at a base about 40 miles north of Baghdad within the Sunni Triangle at a time where we were experiencing, unfortunately, very heavy casualties. I served in a medical unit where one of my daily responsibilities was to go through a by-name list of every single U.S. service member who had been hit by an attack or who was a casualty of an attack the day before. And my job was to go through this list to see if there was any of our soldiers from our unit. We had nearly 3,000 soldiers there to make sure that they got the care that they needed, to make sure that they were either being taken care of or evacuated and gotten to where they needed to go. And it really struck me personally and deeply, understanding that behind each of those names was a worried family member at home, stressed with the thought of that phone ringing with that most dreaded phone call. It made me question whether or not those in Washington who had voted for this war in Iraq, were they kept up at night every day thinking about each of these names, each of these people, those who gave their lives, those who were injured, those who came home and are still dealing with the after effects of war? And coming out of both of those deployments for me was a major reason why I ran for Congress in 2012, so that I could be in a position to help make decisions about when and where our military power is used, and just as importantly, when and where it is not used.
Now, let's hear a very different perspective. Elvire Ahmetovich is a teacher in St. Louis, Missouri. 25 years ago, he was a boy living through a war, now regarded as the most devastating conflict in Europe since the end of World War II. Around 100,000 people were killed during the Bosnian War, including more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys over the course of just a few days. It came to be known as the Srebrenica Massacre. Elvire survived the war, survived the massacre, and moved to the U.S. as a refugee back in 2002. Here is Elvire's story in his own words.
I was only 11 years old when the war started, and I hadn't the faintest idea about what was happening around me. Nor did my parents have much better understanding of the events unfolding in front of their eyes. In May of 1992, soldiers dressed in the very uniforms of the Yugoslav army stormed our village and launched a campaign of brutalization and persecution of the civilians. Those soldiers were mostly Serbs from the neighboring villages, many of whom my parents knew personally. We eventually managed to escape and move to another village nearby Srebrenica, where we would spend the majority of the war, living in a cellar with no windows, running water or electricity. The town of Srebrenica and the villages in the vicinity were completely besieged by the Serb forces, which created a huge humanitarian disaster for the people who lived in the enclave. Living in Srebrenica during this time was a struggle to survive another day, which meant seeking shelter from artillery and sniper fire and scavenging for food. Food was so scarce that my parents would regularly forgo their meals in order to provide for me and my sister. In August of 1992, I was struck by a personal tragedy from which I never truly recovered. My sister Mirella, who was only 4, was killed by a shrapnel from a tank shell that was fired by the Serb forces who were positioned on the surrounding hilltops. My mother was also wounded while trying to save Mirella and barely survived. There are no words that can even remotely describe the feeling of seeing my mother all covered in blood, holding her open belly with her hands while telling me that Mirella was no more. Before the war was over, I also lost my uncle and my 60-year-old grandfather, who was executed at Potočari in July of 1995 during the fall of Srebrenica. In the light of current Syrian humanitarian crisis, I am constantly reminded of my personal experiences during the Bosnian War and feel deep empathy towards millions of Syrians who are going through a similar ordeal. While I don't want to draw too many parallels between the Bosnian and the Syrian conflicts in a political sense, I cannot help but compare the two on a purely humanitarian level. The civilians of Syria are suffering just like the civilians of Bosnia did, and through no fault of their own. Which brings me to the role of the international community and its repeated failure to protect civilian lives in conflicts around the world. Rwanda and Bosnia serve as perfect examples. We can point to many contributing factors to those failures, such as the lack of resolve and political will, coupled with complicated geopolitical circumstances and vested interests of major world powers. I wish there is an easy formula for resolving these conflicts, but I'm afraid that there isn't one. I believe that the US intervention in the Bosnian War, although belated, was instrumental in bringing the war to a close. But that doesn't necessarily warrant similar intervention in Syria. I do remain hopeful that some solution will be found, rather sooner than later.
That's Elvir Ahmedovic in his own words. Let's continue the conversation now. Joining us from New York is Edward Luck. He's a former UN Assistant Secretary General, instrumental in developing and implementing the doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which underscores the duty of the international community to prevent and halt genocide and other mass atrocities. Edward Luck, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Joining us through the web is retired U.S. Navy Admiral James Stavridis. He served as the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, where he oversaw operations in Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, and the Balkans. Admiral Stavridis joins us today from Tufts University near Boston, where he is now the Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Admiral, welcome to the program.
Happy New Year. Good to be with you.
Same to you, sir. And finally, we have Stephen Kinzer on the line. Stephen is a longtime foreign correspondent for The New York Times. His new book coming out soon is about the origins of our debate over foreign intervention called The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of the American Empire. Stephen Kinzer, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Let me start with you, Edward Luck. I listened to the essay and I wonder whether we might be framing this whole discussion about humanitarian intervention the wrong way. How do we keep this discussion balanced between the literal costs of war to the country that intervenes and the human cost of war to the people who are begging for intervention?
Well, it's a very important dilemma, and we don't have any simple solutions to it. I think the responsibility to protect, first and foremost, was about prevention. It wasn't about military intervention. That's a measure of last resort. It's one of the least likely and least attractive options. But prevention can work and has worked many times. Even when I was in the UN, there were 6 or 8 different countries in which we intervened diplomatically, quietly, when there was appeared to be imminent violence against civilians, and people turned around and changed their policies. There's many cases of of UN peacekeepers making a difference, of a preventive deployment of peacekeepers in places like Macedonia, Burundi, East Timor, that help prevent an escalation. There's many, many things that one can do short of a military intervention. And when you do intervene, it's better to do it with partners and better to do it through the UN with Security Council authorization.
Stephen Kinzer, what do you think, balancing the literal cost with the human cost?
I think the responsibility to protect idea has been perverted into meaning something like the responsibility to bomb, the responsibility to invade, responsibility to overthrow governments that we decide we don't like. It's naturally heartrending to hear the stories of people suffering on the ground. I personally covered the Yugoslavia war. I was there for Srebrenica. I heard the stories the next day of people telling me what had happened to their fathers and their brothers and their sons. It was horrific. My translator fainted dead away from the horror of it all. But when you see that, you have to ask yourself, why is it? How was it caused? Instead of just looking at trying to resolve the results of political conflict, let's step back and realize that so many of these conflicts were originally caused by outside powers trying to intervene, break up countries, and promote their own interests at the expense of people in those countries. So emotion is fine, but not as a guide for foreign policy. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statesmanship.
Admiral Stavridis, what do you think?
Well, first, I just want to say for Steve Kinzer, I agree with what he's just laid out. And when I was commander of U.S. Southern Command, which had responsibility for military activity south of the United States, I would often point out the fact that the United States has invaded countries in Latin America approaching 140 times in the last about 150 years. And I would often assign my officers to read one of your books, Steve, Bitter Fruit, which I think laid out some of this pretty well. Not to be flacking your book, and I'm sure your upcoming one will be even better. As a military guy, we often turn to what's often called the Powell Doctrine. This is something that Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, national security advisor, and most famously Secretary of State, laid out many, many years ago. And I think it's pretty good. It walks through, is there a national security? Is there an attainable objective? Is it, have all means of nonviolent policy been fully exhausted? This is Dr. Luck's point. I really agree that we need to focus more on prevention and think about the military as the option of last and least desirable resort. And I say that having been that instrument many times in my career.
Stephen Kinzer, how did America get to this status of being the world's policeman anyway? That's some of what you've been looking at for your new book. Where did this notion come from?
It's a very good question, because our real challenge now is not simply to think about what would be a better policy toward Syria or a better policy toward the Middle East or something more specific like that. We have to ask ourselves about the way that we look at the world. And this is something that began way back in 1898, 1900, when we first took our colonies of Puerto Rico and Guam and the Philippines. Since then, we've developed a mindset which you hear politicians repeating like a mantra inside that terrible Washington echo chamber. The United States is the indispensable nation. We must lead the world. Leadership requires toughness. Toughness must be expressed through military power, principally. Besides that, we have a whole host of subsidiary assumptions. American power is inherently virtuous. Our influence is always benign. We have figured out the right way for countries to be run, and people should replicate that. The risks of inaction are too high. As a result, we overlook factors that repeatedly argue against this point of view. The collateral damage it inflicts on our soldiers and on other people, the way it multiplies our enemies. We are able to achieve our short-term objectives because we have such great military power. But history doesn't stop. You know, in writing, we have this cliche, every story is either happy or sad, depending on where you end it. All these interventions produce huge amounts of backlash that go on for years and decades. We forget the interventions, but the people in the target countries do not. Those histories burn and fester in their hearts and their souls and their minds, and they're looking for a way to get back at those who caused that damage. So we need to be thinking not only about how to resolve our immediate problems, but our longer-term problems. And the reason we have difficulty doing that is that Americans are very compassionate people. We hate the thought that people are suffering anywhere. And whenever our leaders want to lead us into some intervention in the world for any reason, they realize this and they cloak their intervention in this humanitarian garb so that it seems that the Samantha Power, Hillary Clinton type of intervention is different from the Wolfowitz, Cheney, Rumsfeld view, but actually underneath, when you strip the rhetoric away, it still is a result of this view that the United States somehow has an insight, a key to prosperity and success in the world, and it would be so churlish of us not to share it with others, especially those countries that are so backward they don't even realize that they need our help, our guidance, and our leadership.
This is the 1A podcast from WAMU and NPR. You can reach out to us anytime. Email us 1A@WAMU.org. Now, we're a new show. We're still figuring things out. So let us know what you like and what we could do better. I also know that listening to the news all week, including this program, is a responsibility, it's a duty, it's an obligation of citizenship, and it's a pain in the neck sometimes. But wait, wait, don't tell me. The NPR News Quiz is kind of like Advil for the aching mind. Host Peter Sagal asks his panelists like Alonzo Bodden, PJ O'Rourke, and Paula Poundstone about the headlines and the very bizarre stories in the back pages. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me says the things on the radio that most of us just yell at the radio. You can find Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app. Again, search for NPRONE. You can also find it and our podcast and many more at npr.org/podcasts. All right, let's get back to today's discussion about America's future role as an international leader regarding humanitarian crises. Let's get to some more comments from the audience. Nasser tweeted us, "In Libya, after the dictator was toppled, the Libyans were left in a dizzying political vacuum instead of helping them build a new state." I did want to ask you about that. Admiral Stavridis, the only time that the UN Security Council has ever officially invoked responsibility to protect was in Libya. There was the intervention, this post-intervention rebuilding process that by many accounts, as Nasser tweeted, did not go well. What do we learn from this experience?
Well, Nasser's got it exactly right. The absolute failure was simply walking away from it. I mean, to again quote General Powell, this is kind of the pottery barn rule, it's often called. If you break it, you own it. And we, the European Union, NATO, the United States, pretty much everybody just walked away. And we were left, we left the Libyans in a terrible situation. And we're paying the consequences of that today. It's a very good example of the misuse of the military tool when you simply stop and walk away.
Stephen Kinzer, what do you make of our intervention in Libya?
I think it was a disaster, but not just for the reasons that you heard. I don't think that the problem was we didn't stay long enough. It's true, I like that pottery barn rule. If you break it, you own it. But a better idea is don't break it. There was no compelling reason for us to overthrow that regime. And in fact, the Security Council never authorized that. It was never authorized as an operation to overthrow a dictator and then have him stabbed to death in a gully. Once we did that, there was no going back. If we had decided, oh, we've now broken it, we have to send in 100,000 troops and spend 20 years rebuilding Libya, that would have resulted in an even worse disaster. So the mistake, in my view, was not that we didn't follow up our bombing and assassination campaign with an intervention and a long-term occupation. It was that we launched the operation in the first place. Now, let me add one other point.
Briefly.
It's to something that you said earlier. The United States has a great story to tell. And for those of us who spend a lot of time traveling, it's really lamentable to see how little we tell it. What we show the world in many ways is our ugliest side. You've heard some great examples of exceptions to that. But many people who are told the Americans are going to come in and save you think, are we going to be saved like Libya was saved, like Iraq was saved, like Nicaragua, Guatemala, Iran, Afghanistan were saved? Our record is not good. And we're not as bad as we show the world that we are, but we're not telling the greatness of the American story.
I want to get to another tweet. Nick wrote us, and I'd like all three of you to respond to this briefly. Nick tweeted us, "Just because we haven't done a good job as world police doesn't mean we can't do better. If not us, who?" Good question. Stephen Kinzer, who do you think would be the one to fill that vacuum if we created it?
no single power. There isn't a single one size fits all. And it's true, as your correspondent points out, that we haven't had a very good record. But we've been trying this for 120 years, and we still haven't gotten it right. Maybe there's a moment when we look back and ask ourselves, shall we really go off in this direction at all?
Edward Luck, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I don't think in Syria that we really want to see the future of Syria or the Middle East determined by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. That's not a good alternative. So, you know, we have to find ways of building others in the region. Second of all, it seems to me that the UN record, actually, as much as people don't like the UN record on these things actually is better, particularly on peace building and conflict resolution, because it is disinterested.
Better than the U.S.'s record?
I think so, yeah, because the U.S. can't be disinterested. We're too big, we're too powerful, we have too many interests in too many places. There are times American power is absolutely essential. But, you know, the conversation started with the representative talking about the terrific costs. Well, the U.S. pays for U.N. peacekeeping about $2.5 billion a year. That's one-half of 1% of our defense budget. We have only a handful of Americans serving in UN peacekeeping. Even China now is paying much more than it used to for peacekeeping. It has thousands now of Chinese signing up for peacekeeping. They recognize that that's the wave of the future, and the U.S. seems to be pulling back. And I worry a little bit that maybe the administration coming in is sour about the UN before it's even tried it. And if I could just say one thing, Joshua, because you mentioned to the admiral that the case of Libya was the only time when the Security Council invoked the responsibility to protect. And many journalists say that. But it absolutely is not true. The Security Council has invoked responsibility to protect in over 50 resolutions. But this was the one that involved the use of force. And so immediately people think that's the only one. But they've used it more than 50 times. And they've accelerated their use of it after Libya.
So what you're saying is that the responsibility to protect has a built-in has built-in provisions to either use military force or not.
Yes, it, gotcha. As I mentioned before, all the preventive measures, all the assistance measures, all the other ways. You know, countries recognize that standing by, watching hundreds of thousands of people being slaughtered is not the answer. So we have to find better tools, and they tend to be multilateral tools. They tend to be regional tools, the neighbors, regional organizations. They tend to be through civil society. Many of them tend to be bottom-up. But standing back and saying there's nothing we can do, let's just let the people die, that's not an answer, and that's not the American way. And I hope that when people talk about America first, they're not talking about the use of America first as isolationism in the late 30s and in the 40s, trying to keep us out of World War II. With France occupied, Britain being bombarded, the Holocaust underway, the people who advocated America first said, let's sit back and see what happens. It's just a European problem.
Admiral Stavridis, very briefly, who do you think would step in to fill that gap?
It's all of us. No one of us is as smart as all of us thinking together. Think of Wikipedia. Every day, thousands of people input to it, millions take it out. We need international cooperation, interagency cooperation, and I would argue above all, private-public cooperation. It's hard, it's complicated, but it really is a coalition that needs to step in and take these things on. And I think the United Nations is, as flawed as it is as good a point place. And to Dr. Luck's point, 125,000 UN peacekeepers around the world today, about a dozen are from the United States, and they're doing pretty good work.
One last voicemail from a listener. Let's see if we can squeeze this one in very briefly.
Hi, guys. This is Yannicka in Tenasket, Washington. Please talk about the Sudan, where I have heard every now and then little snippets that there is a genocide brewing. I would imagine it would be similar to Rwanda. But whatever is going on, I hear so little about it, and I want to know what your guest thinks about preventing it as opposed to going in and bombing later or just leaving them alone. Thank you.
Edward Luck, can you respond to that one? Very, very briefly. You got about 20 seconds.
Okay, South Sudan is a disaster we created. We never should have created that country. We charged into Sudan and ripped it apart. Now we have broken it, and we are faced with terrible options. The mistake was creating that country and breaking a country into two from the outside with our outside ideas of what should be done there. That's what's created the mess, and now we're left with this terrible set of unpalatable options.
Well, we'll see what happens under the Trump administration to respond to Sudan and any number of crises around the world. That was Stephen Kinzer, columnist for the Boston Globe, senior fellow at the Watson Institute. His new book coming out soon is called The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Great, thank you.
Edward Luck is a former UN Assistant Secretary General, professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Edward, thank you.
And thanks very much.
And Admiral James Stavridis, the Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts and a former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. Admiral, thank you very much.
What a treat.
That's our podcast for today. Thank you for listening. Please do leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It'll make it much easier for other listeners to find us. One more reminder, if you're looking for the entire show, we post all the audio from the show on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. If you have any ideas on what you'd like us to talk about in the weeks and months to come, just email us, 1a@wamu.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening.